This is the SF Signal Podcast, episode number 5, powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author and a blogger over at atfmb.com. And tonight I am joined by the folks who bring us sfsignal.com each and every day to talk about the news that caught our attention this week or whatever else I decide to throw at them. This week I am joined by four great folks. First up is Mr. Jay Garman.
Hi, I'm Jay Garman. I'm a technology journalist by day, and by night I blog at jgarman.net and help run the Conglomeration Science Fiction Convention in Louisville, Kentucky.
Ooh. We are also joined by Ms. Karen Burnham.
Hello. Let's see, I blog at spiralgalaxyreviews.com, but tonight I shall claim the title of scholar. If we're going to be talking about genre issues and genre categorization. And so I also have presented papers at the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts and written for New York Review of Science Fiction and a couple other places.
Yeah, but you also have some associations with space in general.
And I work for NASA, yes.
which brings me to the question that I meant to ask you last time, but DiNardo wouldn't let me. But he's not here tonight, so I can ask. Where's my damn jetpack?
Oh, it's always the jetpacks with you people. We don't trust you with the jetpacks. Stop asking.
Okay. We also have with us tonight a newbie, Matt Smith.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Matthew Sanborn Smith. I write short stories. You can find some of my stuff wandering around on the web. I do some stuff on Starship Sofa, and I've got my own podcast called Beware the Hairy Mango at bewarethehairymango.com.
And last but never ever least, my partner over at the Functional Nerds, Mr. John Anilio.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy and some other nerdy things. You could find a lot of my songs over. Actually, I have them at a new place. It's called Bandcamp, so you can get it at johnanilio.bandcamp.com, including my new song, I Should Be Writing. And you could follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/johnanilio, J-O-H-N-A-N-E-A-L-I-O.
Now, tonight is extra special fun, guys and gals, because DiNardo's not here. And it figures that he would show up, or he would decide not to show up on the one night when we all have bagels.
Glad that all those showed up. Awesome.
So I feel bad. You know, I know he's going to be listening to this. He's going to be like, they got bagels without me?
Yeah, I'm cutting into my onion bagel right now, and it is delicious.
It is. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it.
I'm putting the schmear on my strawberry bagel.
And you know what? The fun of the internet and of Skype is that I am. It's like as soon as I start talking about DiNardo, I get a little message here from JP France. I'm wondering if he wants to join us on the show. I'm going to let that go for just a second and see if he decides to join us. But I just thought it was amusing that DiNardo was gone this week. The topic this week is kind of fun. Hold on one second, guys. This is the fun of Skype. I'm gonna see if I can add JP here. We're gonna add him to the conference call. This is the part of the podcast that people don't really get to hear that often.
This is the exciting
part. Edit it out, right?
Hey, JP.
Hey.
Introduce yourself.
I'm JP. How's it going?
We just got started, so I said, you know what? We're just going to go ahead and add JP.
Okay, sounds good.
So we were just telling everybody how it's kind of sad that tonight of all nights, DiNardo's not here and we all have bagels.
He'd be very upset.
He will be. But you know what? Now we have a good crowd, and I think we should move on to the topic this week, which, as John Anilio pointed out earlier in before we started recording, really kind of got the emails flowing. Essentially, I'm asking, what is the sci-fi equivalent of sword and sorcery? Sword and Sorcery has been getting a lot of press recently thanks to the new anthology from Lou Anders and Jonathan Strahan, or I don't know how to pronounce
it. Strawn.
You know what needs to happen is he needs to call us and come on the podcast and then tell me how to pronounce his name. Anyway, what I wanted to know is this. Is there a science fiction counterpart to this genre? And if so, what is it? How do you guys define it? And lastly, give us a title of something that we can go out and read as proof of your definition. And in the emails that were passed back and forth this week, Jay Garman said it best. Kudos to you, Jay. It might be useful to do an analogy. Sword and Sorcery is the gritty, personal, down-and-dirty alternative to high epic fantasy. So, high fantasy is to space opera, as Sword and Sorcery is to what? Jay Garman.
I would say cyberpunk is the sci-fi equivalent of Sword and Sorcery because it's about individuals with sort of very limited resources on very personal missions. You know, I would very much take hero protagonist from Snow Crash and make him sort of equivalent to Elric in that, you know, it's just sort of this one dude with a certain set of skills and literally a sword going up against, you know, basically very personal enemies, and sometimes the stakes are high, but it's very gritty. And you know, if you want to say technology is the equivalent of magic, when you go fantasy to sci-fi, that, you know, a guy in his PC just hacking the world is pretty much, you know, sort of the equivalent there. And I know that most people don't, you know, equate sort of the high adventure of cyberpunk with anything fantastic, but that's sort of the point to me of Sword and Sorcery, especially as it's sort of been revived, is that it's not high and epic and Tolkien-esque. It's very in the muck. Right. And nobody reads cyberpunk and goes, unless it's like Diamond Age, which I really wouldn't even call cyberpunk, it's always in the muck. That's the point of it. It's, you know, if you want the one guy who's sort of on his own, you know, man with no name style against the world with just very basic skills, cyberpunk is the sci-fi genre for you.
Okay. Well, Matt Smith, what do you think?
Well, I disagree with cyberpunk. I definitely agree with the concept of one guy, one sword against the world. That's what attracted me to Conan when I was growing up. My take on it is more like... It doesn't really have a genre name. It's like the pulp adventure science fiction from the 40s and 50s. And I was going to go with a couple of Harlan Ellison short stories to illustrate my point, but then I remembered that The Green Odyssey by Philip Jose Farmer is a perfect example of this. It's total adventure. It has... fantasy trappings in that it has kings and royal courts and things like that, but it's totally science fiction. An astronaut gets stuck on a planet. He's enslaved. It's sort of a barbarous planet, and he hears that two other astronauts are being held somewhere, you know, far away, and then he goes on this epic adventure.
Didn't that star Charlton Heston?
I have no idea. It should have if it didn't.
It sounded an awful lot like Planet of the Apes.
Maybe Sean Connery in leather. But
oh, it burns. It burns.
And just for the record, you don't want to mention any titles of Harlan Ellison stuff without his permission because he might sue you.
Well, I'm glad I didn't then. I love Harlan Ellison. He's a magnificent gentleman.
So, Karen, you said you had done epic amounts of research into this. So, would you?
Oh yeah, I pulled the whole book off my shelf, and also talked to Gary Wolf.
So this is an actual real book.
A real book, a paper book.
Wow.
A paper book. I actually have to sort of prop up because it's huge. It's the second edition of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. But then it didn't have what I thought it was going to have, so I talked to Gary Wolf, and he confirmed my suspicion. So, of course, you had Sword and Sorcery. It was starting in the 20s and the 30s. You had Conan. You had all these things. And you also, at the same time, even a little earlier, you had Edgar Rice Burroughs writing Princess of Mars,
sure.
Which I think is your absolute archetypal sci-fi Sword and Sorcery book. It's exactly what you guys were talking about. One guy against the world, saving the pretty girl, having, you know, suspiciously high amounts of familiarity with whatever native weaponry he happens to come across. In the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, that sort of thing they're calling planetary romance, but I'm pretty sure that the phrase sword and planet story kind of fits it a little better, gets that sword and sorcery analogy going all the way. And the other person who was really well known for that was Leigh Brackett, writing in the 40s and 50s. She wrote lots of those kind of stories. She actually also helped write the screenplay for Emperor Strikes Back.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of the reasons that's a little better written than some of the other Star Wars.
One of the many, many reasons it's better written than the rest of the Star Wars.
Now,
yeah.
I thought The Empire Strikes Back was written by Hugo on Lost.
But I have to admit, of the stuff I read recently that was published recently, I actually read Conan just a few weeks ago for the first time ever, so that I sort of have a feel for what sword and sorcery meant back in the original days. And the thing that really jumped out at me about the Conan stories was how much it was the purity of brute force violence over right. the sneaky magic stuff, you know, as if, and I think you can draw a direct analogy between the sneaky magic stuff and the sneaky technological stuff. And so the book that really jumped out at me as filling that role in the 2000s was Richard Morgan's Altered Carbon, his Takeshi Kovacs series.
Hmm.
So in that universe, you've got the main it's people have colonized other planets and it's far future. And people have sort of effective immortality because their brains are in a quantum computer. And when their body dies, you can just plug the quantum computer into the next body. So he runs around just killing epic amounts of people. And then I remember one scene really stood out to me where he goes into the science lab and it's all these bad scientists who've been doing something sneaky and evil. And he doesn't just go around and shoot them all normally dead. He also takes out their quantum computers and shoots those. And if that's not exactly that sort of Conan against the Wizards moment, I can't think what is.
Well, and Conan is a perfect example of sorcery, really, in my opinion. John and Elio, what are you thinking?
Well, you know, I went and I reread that the blog post that was on the Mind Meld on SF Signal, and I think it was Jay that mentioned earlier. James Eng described it as fantasy with dirt, as what Sword and Sorcery is, which I guess is a quote from somebody else. But you know, I was really looking around at stuff, and I couldn't find a whole lot of stuff that I read because I was kind of looking at more modern takes on it. And a couple things that I came up with that I took from the Mind Meld that I read was that it's you know, kind of a smaller story typically. And as opposed to a big epic, and also that it's more the protagonist is generally a little bit morally ambiguous. A couple of examples that I had of that of a recent sort of science fiction book is InfoQuake by David Lewis Adelman, because that it's sort of a you know, like a business in the future where there, you know, there's sort of these bio logics and all this kind of stuff. And it's the protagonist you're not necessarily rooting for the whole time. And so that's sort of the closest that I come to of a science fiction where you have a main character who you're not sure if they're in the right or not. A couple of other examples that I found, that I read is also even some of Cory Doctorow's stuff, like Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. It's a very sort of personal story, and you know the protagonist of that is quite morally ambiguous as well. So I think there's a lot of examples in recent science fiction of these, you know, main characters not necessarily being a hero. So in that way, that was sort of the closest that I can come to with equating it to sword and sorcery.
Okay. Well, JP, what are your thoughts?
Well, Matt and Karen took what I was going to say first off, which was the pulpy planetary romance swords and planets type stuff.
Do you want me to make them pay by hanging up on them?
No, that's all right.
Okay. I do it for you, man.
Well, that's very nice, very kind of you. So, you know, a modern day take on that, I guess, would be Chris Roberson's Perigeia, which is, you know, a Soviet astronaut gets stranded on Mars and then has to go adventuring across the planet to try and find her way back, which I thought was just a terrific book, and it, you know, a very nice homage to the pulpy stuff of like Lee Brackett or Edgar Rice Burroughs. But then I remember one of the stories from Swords and Dark Magic that I liked a lot was Hugh the Tint Master by Michael Shea. And that's pretty much a Jack Vancian dying Earth type setting, which I really liked a lot. So I thought, oh, you know, Jack Vance, that kind of thing is really cool. So for a, you know, a more modern day version of that, I think Matt Hughes's Arcanite series fits that bill quite well. It's got a very Vancian feel to it, you know, far future, but technology is verging pretty much on magic at that point. And his stuff is just really, really good. If you haven't read it, I would suggest you read that kind of stuff, too.
Okay. Well, one of the things that Karen brought to mind when you said something about, you said space romance?
Was it planetary romance.
Planetary romance. I also came across a phrase that was sword and planet as sort of a description for this sort of subgenre. But one of the things that I was thinking was, you know, Michael Moorcock has had some books that I think would fall into this. I think Mike Resnick definitely would fall into this. You know, the flagship series. I don't feel that is like epic. I don't feel that it's like a space opera. I think it falls definitely into this sort of sword and planet thing that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. That was one of the thoughts that I had when I was sort of, you know, thinking about what I wanted to put with this, because that's, I guess that was sort of advertised as being more of a space opera. But, you know, it is sort of the story of one man, and it doesn't go crazy into the science or anything. It's more, you know, straight up, you know, in that way, kind of telling a pretty direct linear kind of story.
Exactly.
Let me. I just thought of another one because I'm looking here at my bookshelf, and I see.
Well, that's always handy.
Yes, it is. I would say the Stephen Hunt's steampunk-ish series that starts. What's the first one? Court of the Air, and followed up with Kingdom Beyond the Waves. It is steampunk-ish, but it also has the that, you know, the far future flavor. It's dirty. It's gritty. It's really, really great stuff. I don't know if you guys have read that or not.
I haven't. Anybody else?
No.
If you like, you know, it's not full-fledged steampunk. It's sort of like quasi, is it an Earth
hot water
future?
Punk.
Yeah, exactly. There's a little bit of that. There's some, you know, it's like a Victorian-ish type setting for one of the countries. And yeah, I just found them to be a lot of fun. There's a lot of adventure. You know, there's some science. There's some stuff that you would think would be magic. There's almost, you know, like a supernatural element to them. They're just a lot of fun.
Well, and see, I think you just hit on a word that really helps to describe this, because it fits to both the fantasy and the science fiction, and that's adventure. It's an adventure. It's fast paced. You know, it's kind of, you don't have 10,000 subplots going through the story, you know, and all these threads that kind of have to be pulled together. It's like Karen said, it's Conan hacking through to the bad guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm sorry, John, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
Oh, you know, I was the book that the Stephen Hunt book that JP was describing made me think of Crystal Rain by Tobias Bukel.
Oh, yeah, that'd be another one.
Yeah, I think that kind of fits into that sort of thing too, where, I mean, that's considered sci-fi, but there's really, I mean, they're basically on the one planet in a sort of a you know, all of Tobias's books have that sort of Caribbean kind of vibe to it, and it's supposed to be sort of a Caribbean type of people that are settled there. And yeah, it is quite a bit like that. There is sort of steampunk elements to that a little bit, but it is sort of the you know, has that whole vibe going on. So that made me think of that, which is what I wanted to say.
The other thing that I was thinking, and this isn't necessarily there's probably have been books written about it, but I'm just thinking, you know, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, that kind of stuff also fits into this little category.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
Wow, for a topic that just had everybody emailing like crazy, you guys are being awful quiet right now.
Well, I will say that I can't quite buy the Arcanate series as Sword and Planet or Planetary Romance or what have you. It's just not violent enough.
Ooh, and suddenly Karen brings a little drama to the podcast.
That's true. It's not as violent as some of the other things, but you know, there is some of that. But for the Dying Earth, it's not really that violent either, and that gets lumped in a little bit as well. I think it's just more of a flavor.
Well, it certainly has the sort of standalone hero and the you know, fairly linear plot and I have to admit, I love that Dying Earth feel to the Arcanate series, but it always seemed a little more cerebral to me.
Well, I think to Karen's point that I think the effectiveness of violence is a key part of the sword and sorcery genre. It always crops up, you know, it gets popular in bad economic times, you know, the 30s and then again in the 70s, and now it's coming back again. And I think it's sort of this reaction to nothing's going right, and you really want a story about a guy who can just grab a sword and get crap done against these sort of entrenched powers that are exploiting everybody. And I think the violence and the effectiveness of the violence is a key part of that, because it's, again, sort of this adolescent power fantasy that goes all the way back to the pulps. And maybe the reason we don't see a whole lot of that directly translated into sci-fi is that, like, comic books and superhero stuff have sort of filled that role in a lot of fiction on the sci-fi side. You know, we don't necessarily need a direct allegory when you've got, you know, Wolverine or Iron Man that sort of can be the one lone dude that go out and just, through a linear plot, mow down the guys that are the problem.
Okay, I can see that a little bit. I don't know about the superheroes necessarily. I can see Wolverine because he's modeled more after, you know, like the lone samurai. He's not necessarily, and unless he's in the hands of the wrong writer,
which is only like 80% of the time.
So. Yeah, I know. Okay, so Matt, did you have any other thoughts on this? You've been kind of quiet.
No, I think Jay made a couple of excellent points. I was trying to think earlier today if any of this science fiction version of Sword and Sorcery was being written today, and I couldn't think of anything, but then maybe, you know, it's just crap that I wouldn't pick up.
Which also reminds, I mean, has anybody seen like any decent anthologies? This whole thing started because of the Swords and Dark Magic anthology, you know, catching my eye and making me think about this. Have we seen any anthologies for this genre of science fiction?
Well, I it's not quite that, but the closest one that I could think of at the top of my head is Federations, the John Joseph Adams one. And the only reason why, even though it's talking about these systems, the star systems, these like Federations a la Star Trek, because just the fact that it is a short story, it does have a sword and sorcery type of vibe, because, you know, they can't get too into like these big fantastic worlds and a hero's journey and all that. It's got to be a fairly quick story. So some of the stories in that maybe could be a little bit along those lines. But if anybody has any other ones to throw out there, I would like to hear them.
JP?
I can't think of any.
Karen, you got anything?
I have to say, just to give a shout out to some of the classics, I am pretty sure that I think it's Nesfa Press has released a collection of Leigh Brackett's old, you know, Sword and Planet stories. And I think it came out just a little while ago. Her main character, who was the hero, you know, the Conan of that universe, I think Eric Stark. And I, you know, just to give a shout out for, again, somebody who doesn't necessarily get reprinted all the time anymore.
Well, sure. And you know, one of the things to point out is that a lot of the stuff that you've been talking about, that everybody's been talking about, the older stuff, the Edgar Rice Burroughs, who else was I thinking, like Robert Howard, these guys who wrote these stories in the 20s and 30s and earlier than that, those are available. I mean, you can get those for free.
Project Gutenberg.
Gutenberg. Yep, you can get it there. There's iPhone apps. There's an iPad app. I think Apple put them together to try to keep people from selling those titles. They put all those up for free. So, you know, some of the stuff that we're talking about, you could go out right now and just grab and be reading it and enjoying it. So,
Sorry. Yes? I was going to say maybe all of this stuff is sort of distinctly in the past because stories today, fiction today, has a completely different philosophy behind it. We have to have character change. We have to have, you know, some sort of emotional tie to whatever's going on. And, you know, the sword and sorcery stories and the planetary adventure stories are just about having fun and killing people.
Yeah, and character growth with Conan, not so much.
not so much with Conan, I would agree. You know, he's more like hack some people to death and then check out the girls and
see who's available. And those people who want that kind of entertainment don't tend to be readers at this point in sort of the media evolution. You know, that's what WWE is for.
you had to bring in the wrestling, didn't you?
Well, I got to take my shots at the Sci-Fi Channel where I can get them. And we didn't talk about Mansquito, so here we are.
Oh, that's terrible. All right. You know what? I think we're going to have to call this one done, folks. Thanks to everybody for coming on. JP, you missed it in the beginning, but Karen promised us all jetpacks, which I thought was kind of cool.
That's awesome.
Stop asking.
All right. How about death rays? Can we talk death rays? You got to work on death rays.
I can neither confirm
nor deny. Those junk satellites are not going to get rid of themselves.
She can neither confirm nor deny the existence of a secret moon base.
That's all I'm saying.
I just flashed on Austin Powers for some reason with the secret moon base. All right. I think we're done. Thanks, everybody, for coming on. And we'll see you next week.
Great. Thanks so much.
See you.
Thank you.
And now for the interview portion of the SF Signal podcast. I'm actually joined by one of our own. This is Karen Burnham. And Karen has lots to talk about today, don't you?
Indeed, absolutely. Tons and tons.
You are a regular contributor to SF Signal. You also have your website, Spiral Galaxy, where you do reviews.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of what are you reviewing? What are you into?
Well, let's see. Recently on Spiral Galaxy, it's been a little heavy on the classics. When I first got into the community and started talking with people like Charles Brown and Gary Wolfe, I realized just how much of the history of the field they knew and I didn't. And, I mean, I'd read, you know, your Asimov, Clark, Heinlein, Axis. I'd picked up people like Dan Simmons and David Brin in the 90s when I, you know, was a diehard teenager reading SF. But then I sort of embarked on a fairly serious attempt to get up to speed in the genre classics and antecedents. And I just sort of solicited input from all these different people and different books I was reading about, you know, what was important from, right now I'm just finishing up sort of the important genre antecedents from the pre-Golden Age.
Okay.
And like, so I've read like a bunch what? Of, well, some of the really fascinating stuff I found was things like, well, of course you got your Mary Shelley Frankenstein. You can't go wrong with that. You've got all your Jules Verne, you've got all your H.G. Wells, but I had read a lot of that in high school and college. So I started picking up some of the stuff like William Hope Hodgson, of course, some Lovecraft. Lord Dunsany was one of my favorite finds. He wrote pretty pure fantasy, and he's especially charming at the short length. But reading all this stuff, I mean, you know, in the days when weird tales was your main genre outlet and people were selling, you know, SF Westerns to whoever would buy them, you know, you got... It was what genre was before all the genre walls went up. So you've got William Hope Hodgson, and I don't actually like his writing that much, but it's fascinating because at the same time, it is SF and fantasy and horror and mystery and just whatever the heck else he felt like doing at the time.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the genre walls, because that is a bit of a hot topic these days, depending on who you talk to, because there's a lot of people who want more separation between science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, I don't entirely understand that. I mean, for me, it's story. I mean, I have to admit, I used to describe myself as primarily a science fiction reader. I'm an engineer. I was a geek girl. I love my Tolkien, don't get me wrong, but, you know, Jules Verne, again, Dan Simmons and the Hyperion Chronicles, David Brin, that sort of thing. But then I, you know, really came to appreciate just the good writing and the good writing of ideas. And you can get that from science fiction or fantasy or all of the above mixed together in an interesting amalgamated stew. So I have to admit, I'm one of the people who goes, hey, just write what sounds interesting and we'll figure out what genre it is if we have to.
Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned like the pulp kind of magazines and people trying to sell, you know, science fiction westerns, because there was that time in America where it seemed like everything was a western.
Yeah. Oh, if you read Edgar Rice Burroughs, he was writing westerns. I mean, sure. Although, let's see, Gary and Jonathan made an interesting point. Gary K. Wolf and Jonathan Strawn on their podcast made an interesting point the other day that the beginning of Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Princess of Mars marks the end of the effective Western. When John Carter gets chased into a cave by Indians and he has nowhere to go, and so he falls asleep and teleports to Mars. It's like, that's a nice image right there.
Yep. And we kind of talked briefly about the fact that a lot of the stuff that you're talking about now is available through the Gutenberg Project.
And I have been a huge subscriber to Gutenberg for years. I like reading a lot of my stuff on in various electronic formats. So it has worked for me, even when I was doing things like going back and rereading the Iliad and the Odyssey for my own edification. I think I didn't get the Canterbury Tales on Gutenberg. I actually got a Norton Critical for that. But yeah, I mean, you can find so much of this stuff in formats that are easy to translate into other formats, too. You can either have a text file or you can, you know, transfer that into almost any format you need it to be in.
Sure. And Apple, of course, has put it up in their iBook reader.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And
for free.
Even before iBooks came out, I've been reading a lot on my iPhone, and Stanza hooks directly into the Project Gutenberg library. You can just point and click and get books from Gutenberg downloaded onto your phone.
That's kind of cool. I also, like you mentioned, the Iliad and the Odyssey. I have probably one of the oldest books that I own that I have just carried with me, you know, through two or three cross-country moves and all this kind of stuff. And it's just this ancient-looking copy of Bullfinch's Mythology.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I want to say that I got it, like, in the fifth or sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have it. And I mean, that was really one of the first kind of stepping stones for me to kind of get into this stuff, was the Bullfinch's Mythology, and then C.S. Lewis, and then, you know, just all the stuff that came after that. There was Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and, you know, just an incredible amount of stuff. And I even wonder if people are younger people are reading that stuff today, you know. And that's kind of why I like the Gutenberg Project, because they are making those things available to an audience that might not otherwise read them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really good to be able to get things. The other thing I kind of like about Gutenberg, it's stripped down. It's not anybody's interpretation of, well, I mean, anything that's translated has an element of the translator's interpretation. But you're not sort of overburdened by the critical introduction and the explanatory footnotes. You kind of get to, you know, make up your own mind about it. Yeah. I've been so glad that I've read this stuff on my own after college without having to worry about writing a paper that needs a grade. And I have to admit, I've come up with some very idiosyncratic readings of things like the Iliad and the Canterbury Tales just because of why and when I was reading them for my own purposes instead of for school.
Well, sure. And I mean, there's often a path, you know, as you read one thing and then someone suggests something else, and you just kind of bounce back and forth and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, just to throw out something a little from left field, are you aware of the oh my gosh, there's a bookstore in London that actually has a machine, and you can purchase like an ebook, but they'll print it and bind it for you right there in the store.
I heard about something like that. I didn't know where it was.
That's kind of cool. I think that'd be neat for that to spread a little bit more. And so that kind of opens up things from the Gutenberg Project. It opens up people who have self-published pieces. Mm. You know, someone can still come to the store, buy it, and then walk away with the book, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah.
You got some other things. We didn't actually talk too much about who you are, because we've done that a couple times now, just in the opening parts of the podcast. But do you want to take a minute just to do a little bit of an expanded who is Karen?
Sure. Let's see. I've basically described myself as having two almost independent lives, and my vocation is an engineer. I work for NASA. I have a bachelor's degree in physics and a newly minted master's degree in electrical engineering.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I bet that was a lot of hard work.
So very glad to be done. So very, very glad, especially the last three semesters of my master's, I was also working full-time.
Oh my gosh.
I don't want to do that again. Yeah. I am enjoying having my brain back, frankly. of course, I was very lucky to get a job at NASA before I had completed my master's degree, so I do not want to look that gift horse in the mouth. So that's my vocation. And at NASA, I have the incredible privilege to work on two different things that are awesome. The electrical equipment that gets plugged into the space station, and I help work on flight hardware for that, testing flight hardware.
Nice.
And also, I help work with the pyrotechnics branch, which is almost, but maybe not quite, as much fun as you would imagine. In other words, we don't blow stuff up every day. We're not Mythbusters, but it's still really fun.
Ooh, Mythbusters.
Awesome. Let's see. Show. Oh, it's the best. It's the only show I actually keep up with in close to real time. And then in my other life, I do this reviewing and scholarship thing. I started reviewing in 2004, and I was really bad at it, and so I realized that eventually and stopped for a while. And then I started up again in 2006, and that seemed to work out a little better. And since then, I've gotten more and more involved in the community. I've been in, gone to World Cons, been on panels, and gone to some of the academic conferences that are a little interesting. There's one in Florida every year called the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts. We lovingly call it ICFA. And that's a small little conference. It really is for academics, people who are interested in the academic college-level study of science fiction and fantasy. But it also attracts a number of writers. Peter Straub's a regular. We've had people like Daryl Gregory and Jedediah Barry and folks like that. Mm-hmm. And that's been a huge learning experience for me, being able to interact with those people on that level, people who think about fantastic literature really deeply, and getting to present some papers there. That's been a lot of fun.
Two questions come to mind. One is completely off the wall, so I'm going to start with that.
Go for it.
Are you familiar with the fictional character Howard Wolowitz?
No.
He's on The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, okay, yeah. Everyone says I'd love The Big Bang Theory, but I don't have time to watch it.
it's you know, if you take out the commercials, it's 22 minutes.
Oh, really?
Come on. You can manage that.
Howard, now that I've done with my master's, I can manage that.
Howard Wolowitz is the only member of the foursome who doesn't have, like, a master's. And he's an engineer, and he works on projects for NASA.
Okay.
So that's why I suggest that you might find. He tries to use that association to get girls, and he's really, really, really bad at getting girls. And it just comes to mind. I remember an episode where he picked up a gal at a bar by telling her that she could drive the rover on Mars and took her back to his lab where he's been working on the rover remotely and got the rover stuck. And so I'm just throwing it out there that it's It's pretty amusing.
Gotcha.
Two, that kind of brings to mind the idea of, you know, a lot of times geeks, nerds, different people like myself get frustrated with the things that we watch, the things that we read when they're not accurate. So the classic that everybody still brings to mind today is the little girl in Jurassic Park looking at the computer screen with all the pretty graphics on it and going, oh, this is Linux. I know this, which has no graphics.
Right.
You know, or the fact that all you need to do to bring down the aliens who are destroying the world in Independence Day is a laptop.
With a Mac operating system.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm just curious, you know, from the perspective of someone with a master's degree in this stuff and who is, as John says, a rocket scientist. Do you find that you're drawn more to science fiction that has more accurate portrayals of science, or does it not even matter to you? Are you able to just lose yourself in the prose?
See, that's an interesting question, because to me, it absolutely depends. And one of the things that I've noticed is that if something's wrong with the story, and I don't mean the science, but if something's wrong with the story, if it's broken in some way, then that's when I start getting annoyed and nitpicking the science. Like, basically, if it hasn't pulled me in, if it hasn't grabbed my attention, then I'm sitting there reading in between the lines going, oh, come on, really? Really? Oh, you've got to be kidding. However, there are some books where it's so well written on many different levels that I'll give it a pass until I'm done. And only later will I sit there and, you know, I'll be writing the review and going, oh, hey, that actually didn't make any sense whatsoever, but hey, it was really good while I was reading it. So the one that comes to mind is Robert Charles Wilson's Blind Lake, and that was a little earlier in his career. I love Robert Charles Wilson's ability to do scene and setting and character and world building, and his prose is, you know, some of the best we've got in the field. And so, you know, I went right through that book just like, wow, this is really fascinating. And at the end, I'm like, he does this whole explanation thing. Later on in his career, he just even stops doing the explanation thing. And I think that's a good call for him. Because we got to the explanation, and unfortunately, it hit two of my specialties, especially at the time. It was various kinds of signal processing and then some expert system AIs. And I was like, wow, that wouldn't ever happen in a million bajillion years. But I loved so much else about the book that it was okay. On the other hand, I, you know, have a particular, penchant for Greg Egan, which I know, you know, is kind of the hard SF cutting edge. And I know not everyone's into that. And some people say, oh, I find Greg Egan so hard to understand. Well, I do too. I mean, I've got a degree in physics, and I had to read Schild's Ladder twice just to kind of even barely get what he was getting at. But I feel like it shouldn't matter if the rest of the story is well enough written. You don't have to understand all the details. You know, you don't have to understand why Gandalf can say magic words and have flaming pine cones. You know, just... it is. And with SF, I think you can give it the same benefit of the doubt if it's well written enough.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've kind of gone from someone who wanted enormous amounts of detail to now I struggle to get through it if there's enormous amounts of detail.
Yeah.
It's like, do I really need to know this? Come on, can't you just give me something else?
Yeah, can't we move on to the plot or the character? Yeah. When I found, when I was an undergrad in physics, my specialty was astronomy. And it was only, you know, sort of by chance that I didn't end up as an astronomy major, that and wanting a job someday. And I cannot read general Barnes & Noble physics and astronomy books anymore. I used to love them. I just gobbled them up when I was a teenager. But now I'm just like, okay, you go straight from the stuff that is really, really boring to the stuff that's so out there, I don't even care. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a lot of in-between for someone who has my amount of knowledge about the subject.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Have you ever read, I don't know why it comes to mind, but there was a book that I remember years, I'm probably going back way too far, but Christopher Buckley wrote a book called Little Green Men.
No, I never tripped across that one.
I don't think it's even considered science fiction. It's probably considered, quote unquote, literature.
Literature. Yes.
And it's essentially about a guy who is like a television personality, and he's just ripping apart all these people who talk about they've been abducted by aliens and it's ridiculous and da-da-da-da. And little does he know that there's a little section of the government who's in charge of abducting people and making it look like aliens did it. And and someone there decides to teach a guy a lesson and abduct him. It's actually a hilarious, hilarious book.
Cool.
And I read it years ago.
I can see where that sort of thing could be done well.
And that's kind of what brought it to mind. You were talking about, you know, if it's written well, you kind of let stuff go.
Yeah.
And I want to say that this book was written in the age of X-Files, when X-Files was really big on TV and everybody was, you know, walking around saying, you know, I want to believe. And that's when this book hit, and I want to say it made a little bit of a splash, but not like a huge splash. But it was written well enough, and you laughed through it, that you kind of skipped over the weird stuff that, you know, didn't quite make sense. So you write the occasional post for SF Signal. You've also been writing your posts over on Spiral Galaxy, and that's where you've been doing a lot of the older science fiction stuff.
Right, because I figure, you know, 90 or even 95% of people who read SF don't necessarily want to be reading stuff from the 20s. So, I'm not doing a scholarly take on these things. I'm doing just my own little, how does this strike me these days and in the mood I was in when I read it? So I feel like that's the right venue for those reviews.
Sure. And, you know, a lot of that stuff, though, I almost wonder if we haven't lost something because we don't still do stories that way.
How do you mean?
We've gotten, I think, way into more detail in the books that that are being written today. I feel like there's less adventure and more focus on other stuff.
And some of the stuff written today has certainly disappeared up its own navel.
I'm thinking of I'm not like slamming him anyway, but like Kevin J. Anderson trying to read Hidden Empire, and I'm struggling. Struggling with Hidden Empire. But Scalzi's Old Man's War, I gobbled it up.
There's a reason that was as popular as it was. And yeah, I think just a straight out single point of view, you know, adventure story was desperately needed at the time.
Sure.
And still is.
And the characters within the book are asking the questions, you know, well, how does this work? And how does that work? And how does faster than light travel work? And blah, blah. And people are going, oh.
Right. Yeah. How does your car actually work? I don't know.
Yeah. I put the key in and I turn it. If something else doesn't happen after that, I'm screwed.
Right, then I get a toad.
I've joked, you know, I bought a lawnmower for the house, and I'm like, where's the Bluetooth? Where's the keyboard go? You know, I that's not my thing. That's not who I am. I'm not that guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Old Man's War appealed to me because it was, like you were saying, it's like the first person, and he didn't understand it, so there was no way he could explain it to me, which means I didn't have to go through, you know, 20 chapters of this is how faster than light travel works in this particular universe.
Right.
You know,
although let me tell you, so that's true of the pulps from the pre-Golden Age, you know, your Edgar Rice Burroughs and your Robert E. Howards and even Lovecraft. I ended up reading Lovecraft kind of more as science fiction than as horror. And as a science fiction world builder, he was pretty cool. But when I went and read more of the fantasy stuff, that was much more like what Kelly Link writes today.
I'm not familiar with Kelly Link.
Kelly Link, let's see, she's the editor at Small Beer Press, and she's written a huge number, well, okay, not a huge number, but a number of very successful, very, very weird, fantastic short fiction, and I believe one novel. And she's had a lot of interesting success, not necessarily, I think, financially, but, you know, critically. And I really feel that between her and Neil Gaiman referencing a lot of pre-Tolkien fantasy, that the stuff from the teens and 20s and even like 1890s is becoming as much or more relevant to some of the fantasy written today than the Tolkien stuff is. And I found that to be just a fascinating, like, you had all this fantasy that was obviously influenced by Tolkien, and now we're actually getting some people who go, well, that's not the fantasy I want to write. I want to write fantasy from back here instead. And that's been very interesting. Yeah. So some of the stuff back then even wasn't that straightforward either. That's what I was going for there.
That is interesting because, well, you know, and it's like in music, everybody's saying, well, you know, every band today was inspired by this band who was inspired by this band who ultimately was inspired by the Beatles.
Right.
Well, you know, and who were the Beatles inspired by? Well, the Beatles were inspired by, you know, Little Richard and B.B. King and all these blues guys, you know, from America. So it's kind of like coming full circle again.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Which I'm actually reading right now. Was it The Age of Misrule by Mark Chadbourne?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I just started, I just kind of cracked that open. And that's, the entire piece is about things coming full circle. So it's like, you know, we've come to a point in our history and, you know, technology has been the top of the heap for so long. And now the old gods are back and they want magic to be on top again and say goodbye to technology.
Right, right.
Now, obviously, working for NASA and you're in Texas, do you get a lot of people saying, Houston, we have a problem?
No, and I hope to keep it that way.
And of course, I always bother you about the, well, I don't know. I've always been thinking about bothering you about the jetpacks. You know, I had a long conversation with DiNardo about flying cars, and he's like, with all the accidents that we have, do you seriously want people flying around in cars? I'm like, well, not people, just me.
Me, right.
I'd be careful.
Yeah, that's where it comes down. That's where the rubber meets the road, as it were. Or not.
You know, I find it's kind of just talking about the books and the detail. When I sat down and first started to write myself, I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not an engineer. I don't understand that stuff. And so I always shy away from writing those kinds of things. You know, I suppose I could go out and I could do the research and I could, you know, figure out why planes fly and why this does this and so on and so forth and try to put that in there. But I don't think that necessarily adds anything.
Oh, yeah,
if that's not who you are.
Right. Yeah. Well, and of course I always feel that you should be able to write 90% of your story, you know, your plot, your character, your theme, your setting, and then work out the technical details later. Because as I think so much SF has shown us, you can wave your hands a lot. And again, if people are, you know, if you've engaged people in other ways, they will follow you through it. Yep. I mean, I've given a lot of hand waving to various authors, and usually I'm just happy to let them do it.
So you've read, it sounds like you're extremely well read when it comes to science fiction.
Well, I'm aspiring to be extremely well read.
Well, you've read newer stuff. You've read things that people consider necessary.
I've got a huge gap that comes after the Golden Age. I'm good on pre-Golden Age. I'm feeling pretty solid on Golden Age. I've got a huge gap when it comes to the New Wave. That's my big.
What do you look for when you're, you know, if you're not in the mode of, oh, I got to find a new Lovecraft piece, or, oh, I've got to find something from Burroughs or something from these classics, you know, when you are just looking for something for yourself, for pleasure, that you just want to, you know, escape for a little while, what are you looking for? What's interesting you?
Oh, dear.
Today?
Narrative nonfiction is what I read for pleasure.
Okay.
Because I don't have to review it. Anything I read that's fiction, I end up reviewing. And when I read critical nonfiction, you know, things that deal with the field, I have to pay real attention to that because, you know, it's important to my view of the field, and I'm filling in gaps and this, that, and the other. So what I've read recently, and I've been doing some just nice brain dead reading. Well, not brain dead, but you know, just for fun reading because I'm done with my master's and I need a little mental break before I pick up my next huge project.
Turning your brain off and just kind of
reading for fun. And what I ended up with was two Mary Roach books. I had read her book on cadavers and what happens to cadavers after you die. And that was called Stiff, and it was awesome and had tons of just fun details and questions you'd never even think to ask about, you know, when you donate your body to science, what does that actually mean? You could end up as a crash test dummy. Yeah. You could end up as an experimental head for beauty school students. It's awesome. So I had read that a few years ago, and just
beauty
the last
school
couple
dropout.
Weeks.
Go back just in the to last high couple, school. Sorry, I just...
just in the last couple of weeks, I picked up her Bonk, which is all about poor scientific researchers trying to research sex. And
oh, boy.
Amusements and difficulties that they run into. And then her most recent book is called Packing for Mars. And it's actually very amusing stuff about... the space program and how do we deal with astronauts in space. And I knew some of it already just from being around NASA and soaking up the legendary culture, especially at Johnson Space Center is the manned space flight center.
Wow.
But there was all sorts of stuff in there that I hadn't read before. It was pretty awesome.
Have you had your fangirl moments at NASA?
Oh, heck yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, you can't not. No, I was in Historic Mission Control. A friend of mine had taken me over because he realized I hadn't seen it before. And it's the Mission Control Center that's from Apollo 13.
Mm.
Yeah, or that was during the Apollo era. And we were in there, and it turned out Gene Kranz was filming an interview. And he saw us up there at the observation deck. And he just, like, took a little break and ran on up and introduced himself and said hi. And like, oh, my God. Whenever I feel depressed about being an engineer, I read your book for inspiration. You know, I didn't say that, but I was real close.
I saw there's all this reality television on now, and I used to absolutely hate it. I mean, I was the worst for just telling people what utter crap it was. Mm-hmm. And now I've kind of, as I've watched some different things like Ace of Cakes, which is reality, but it's about cakes. And I never thought I would watch a show about cakes, but Duff cracks me up. And cool. I end up watching it. And Gene Simmons, I watch that now because it cracks me up. And I came across a thing, and it's about a pawn shop. It's like one of the most famous pawn shops in the world, which I didn't even know pawn shops could be famous.
Right, yeah. What would they be famous for?
And this lady brought in, she had in a frame... a picture from one of the moon landings, and she had a little flag, and it wasn't very big. It was probably the size of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And signatures from three astronauts, and it was from one of the Apollo missions, and it was, this flag had gone to the moon.
Wow.
They had carried it. And each of the astronauts had signed the page. And so it said something about, you know, Apollo missions to the moon, da 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 da. And it gave like a date, and it gave the names of the astronauts, and that they took this little flag up and signed it. And they went through all this authentication, and it was real. The flag had actually gone to the moon. The signatures were all real. It was worth a fortune, really. And I just thought it was neat. I didn't realize that the flags were so small that they took with them.
And another thing that they do, especially on shuttle, is mission patches. They'll fly a batch of mission patches, and because again they're small and they don't take up a lot of space, but you know you can actually get mission patches that have been in space.
And that's awesome. But I just tripped me out because it was such a tiny little flag. And, you know, you see all the pictures with the big flag that they like stick in the ground. And you don't think about these tiny little flags that they take with them.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of cool. And I had no idea that any of that had ever happened. Did you see the whole thing? It's like the moon is shrinking.
I don't think I saw that.
The moon is shrinking. It's one of those things where they make a big deal about it, and they've got the huge headline, "The Moon is Shrinking." And right. Then as you read the article, they're talking to the scientist who says, "Yeah, you know, slowly over billions of years, it's not like it's going to come crashing down on us or disappear tomorrow."
Right. Right.
But I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I have to say, I've got a lot of issues with science journalism, and it's actually a field I'd like to expand into, because scientists have trouble communicating, journalists have trouble understanding science, and I really, really would like to get in the middle of that and be one of the people who can, you know, maybe help explain things a little better.
Oh, there's so much bad science in journalism.
Oh yeah, they pick up on these things that don't matter, and you can even read it. Like if you read past the first five paragraphs, you know, at the end of the article, it'll be the scientist or researcher being interviewed, and they're like, no, you don't understand. That's what you think I just said is not at all what I just said.
Well, even worse, I mean, you've got the people, you know, like the people in my family who only listen to the first part of the interview and then get all worked up.
Right.
You know, yeah. Oh, this is happening. Oh, that's happening. And so you didn't read the rest or listen to the rest, did you? I mean, come on.
Nope, just the headline. That's all I need.
Just the headline. That's all you need. That's all any of us need anymore. Well, I think we should probably wrap this up. I've probably kept you long enough for a Saturday afternoon.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think it was awesome. Do you want to pimp your stuff? Do you want to tell people your website and all that good stuff?
Absolutely. Let's see. So my website, www.spiralgalaxyreviews.com, currently featuring mostly reviews of classic SF and fantasy, but soon to be featuring way more Greg Egan than you can shake a stick at, because and John DiNardo will be very pleased. This is something of a first time announcement for me. I'm working on a book on Greg Egan.
Cool.
It will be due in March 2012. I have no idea when it'll be published. And for the book, I'm pretty much going to read, you know, every novel, every short story, reread all the novels I've already read. I'll be, you know, posting my thoughts on that as I go. Then I have to distill all of that plus explain some of the science behind the stories in 70,000 words.
Wow.
Which is going to be a huge challenge. I don't know if you ever heard the quote from Blaise Pascal. He was writing to a friend, and he said, "I apologize for the length of this letter. I had no time to make it shorter." It's a quote I sort of live by. You know, if you really have the time to distill your ideas to a point where you really understand them, you can say a lot in a very short amount of time. And I'm hoping to be able to get to that point with Greg Egan and his au revoir.
Awesome. Well, very cool. We'll be looking forward to that.
Thanks. And thanks so much for having me.
No problem. Thank you.